I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. For so many of us, it's week 2, or 3, or 4 or more of lockdown. In a normal times, something like half of all meals consumed in our country are prepared or from restaurants. And, well, since that's not happening so much right now, you're probably cooking a lot. Maybe you're getting to the point where all your go-to recipes are starting to wear a little thin, and I honestly am right there with you. My lunch, pretty much every single day since I started staying in 2 weeks ago, has been a ham sandwich on an English muffin. It's fine, but the bigger thing is, like, I realized it's just one fewer thing I need to think about during the course of my day right now, and it kind of feels like what I need. But cooking dinner has still been a pleasure, for me at least. It's family cooking, not cooking to impress or to perform or show off. I'm just glad to be able to nourish the bodies and the spirits of the people around me. And I've mostly been making simple food, but, you know, trying to take some care with it. I've been adding, like, diced sweet potatoes to the mac and cheese and cooking down mushrooms to flavor a gravy for meatballs. But like anyone else, I could use a hand, which is why this week we spent an hour on the phone with Samin Nosrat. Samin is the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, one of the best books on learning to cook I have ever read. She's also the star of the Netflix show of the same name, and she has a brand new podcast called Home Cooking. She's one of the most delightful people I know, and she's a fantastic teacher and human to boot. And I called her at home, from my home. We caught up a bit, and later we took a whole bunch of your cooking questions. Hey, Samin, I am so happy to talk to you.
Oh, Francis, I miss you so much.
Oh, God. I miss you too. I miss everyone else as well. But you, you know, at the table of equals, you know, a little more equal than others.
Oh, that's weird.
It's okay. I feel like we have a kind of relationship where most of our relationship is conducted over text anyway. Like, I think we've seen each other in person like 3 times.
Totally.
So this is normal.
Feels kind of normal.
But, you know, speaking of, you know, our various sorts of isolation, you know, you're a writer. I'm a writer. I think we're pretty used to being in our homes working. But you also have a new podcast that just launched called Home Cooking. Congratulations.
Obviously, thank you. People,
yeah. I admit that it came out today, this morning, and I haven't had time to listen yet, but I'm psyched for it.
Oh, and there's plenty of time.
We got time. And, you know, a lot of people know you as a host on your show, but you also taught hands-on cooking for a long time. And since we're all at home right now, are you finding ways to scratch that kind of itch?
Yes, I definitely, you know, it's interesting. There are so many opportunities in a day to teach people. And I have often over the last few years been so divorced from that because I've been like so sort of sucked into my own reality of travel and events and press. And I guess one bright thing about what's happening now is that I can, you know, use what I'm good at to help other people. And that feels really good. And, you know, I'm doing my best to keep myself off of the internet as much as possible. But certainly on Instagram, there's been a lot of incredible creativity. You know, people have been doing really amazing things, teaching all sorts of classes for kids who are trapped at home. Wendy McNaughton, who illustrated my book, is teaching daily drawing classes. And, you know, authors are reading children's books. Julia Tertian, yeah, the great cookbook author and cook, is teaching a daily food writing class. And people are being so generous with their skills, and it really feels good. Like yesterday, I spent a bunch of the second half of the day editing my website and my podcast, and I didn't think about reality at all because I was just so focused on making this thing that's going to help people. So that has felt really good. Yeah. And then, you know, I've always been sort of that person that anyone who has my phone number texts, like, I have salmon and this, well, how do I cook it? Can I substitute this? And so I guess now I just get to do that all day, which is kind of, it brings me a lot of pleasure. It's, I've been having a hard time for several months. I've been really depressed and just like exhausted, and somehow here now being of use feels really good.
Yeah, totally. And I think you're so right. I mean, like, obviously this is a really, really hard time, a really scary time for a lot of people, but there's also this, I made the mistake of going on the internet today, and but I did see this Twitter thread from someone who's like a policy expert, and he said something that's really important for people to try to remember. It's that often in times of natural disaster or, you know, things like that, people kind of often expect the worst of one another, and they expect that society will break down, it's going to be chaos and violence and all that stuff. And some of that stuff happens, but there's so much research throughout history that in those moments, people actually become much more pro-social, much more community-focused, much more sacrifice-oriented and wanting to do good things. And I remember, I actually haven't read this book myself, but my wife reading this book called A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit. And it's totally about that. We talked about it a lot because Hurricane Katrina, you know, touched our lives a lot. And a lot of the book is about Hurricane Katrina, but it's about the fact that on the news you saw quote unquote looting, you saw that stuff and it looked like, you know, just hell. But really what was happening on a day-to-day basis was that people were pulling together in ways that were so powerful and so beautiful. And that is consistent through human history. And, you know, it seems funny to talk about drawing classes on Instagram being part of that, but I think it is part of that. I think people want to help one another right now. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that does feel like it can give us some hope in the world right now.
Yeah, I am so inspired by the way people are showing their best selves right now. Yeah. And I think the same thing's happening here too, where, you know, on the news or whatever version of the news you watch, like for me, it's like very filtered through many people's internets and things. But, you know, you see the empty grocery store shelves or people hoarding 3 years worth of toilet paper. But in reality, what we see is on my street, people taking care of each other. You know, it's nice to sort of get out of our own realities for a minute and understand what other people are going through and build empathy and share sort of the good stuff that we do have, because there is good. There is good for many of us. I mean, a lot of people have really, really dark realities right now. But for those of us who have resources and privilege and even just joy, I think it's our responsibility to share that.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of joy, I think, you know, a lot of people get so much joy from you. They get so much joy from watching you cook and watching you enjoy food and reading you about cooking. So I want to ask you, like, right now, how have you been cooking now that you're staying at home? Like, are you like taking this time to experiment and play with new stuff? Or are you going back to standbys and cooking stuff that you know really well that comforts you? Like, what's your sort of cooking vibe right now?
It's a little bit of both. And I've also noticed that my interest in eating has shifted. Normally, all I ever want to do is eat. I just want to eat all day, every day, everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same geez.
And lately, I kind of have to force myself or just even remind myself that I'm hungry. It's a very, very weird thing for me to go through because this has probably never happened to me. So that's maybe how my body and psyche are dealing with it. But I will say that even if my like experience of eating has changed, my joy in cooking has not. And I love constraints. I love the challenges of constraints. I think that they make us better cooks. And I also love the fact that I have endless time and no feeling like I need to be somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so all of the things that are the really slow, all day kinds of things where I would probably under regular circumstances be loath to turn on my oven, you know, for 4 hours. Those things are a lot more attractive and accessible. And also, I'm being a lot more responsible about using everything up. I think I talk a big game about how to use up leftovers, but I don't always practice that. And now there is a way where I'm folding, you know, everything into the next meal. I think a lot about Tamar Adler and her everlasting meal, because sometimes I'm like, this meal, you know, is going on, you know, that's 14th. permutation. It just never ends.
yeah totally.
But even like, I don't know, the other day I got a text from a friend who said that she was going to pick up some pork from a nearby farmer friend who was trying to, you know, sell some stuff out of the freezer, and did I want any? And my first reaction was, no, I don't. And I'm trying to eat less meat. And then I thought about it for a day and I was like, you know, it's been probably 2 years since I made meatballs. I kind of want to make meatballs. And so I was really excited and I ordered the pork and it came yesterday. And I'm like, kind of just like, what am I going to put in my meatballs? How am I going to do this? So there is some joy in there for me. And also I live sort of in this shared community kind of place. I mean, we're all separately quarantined, but our houses are close enough together and we have a shared courtyard. And so if I make a pot that's too big of, you know, beans or soup or anything, I have plenty of people to share it with.
Mm, yeah. Well, first of all, I want to talk about meatballs. If you figure out what you want to do, let me know, because I actually have ground meat.
You do?
In my fridge. And I'm like, maybe I'll make meatballs this weekend. When's the last time I made meatballs?
I know.
But yeah, you're so right about Tamar Adler. So for those at home, if you don't know her, Tamar Adler is this really, really wonderful writer and cook. She has this beautiful book called An Everlasting Meal that is, you know, on some level about like, you know, using up all the food, not being wasteful, but really it's about, oh, how do you take, you know, the leftovers of one meal and turn it into a new meal and really like sort of have that be a philosophy of life kind of. So I am also co-quarantining with another family, which is really wonderful in a lot of ways. And it's really wonderful to get to cook for a group. And, you know, part of our thing too is like, we're trying to not go out to the grocery store as much as possible. So we need to stretch our fresh food. We need to stretch our fresh produce and our fresh meat and things like that. And so like one day I grilled pork chops for dinner, which felt like totally decadent. But then I cut off the bones from those pork chops and we had some leftover from that meal. And the next day I seared the bones and then just got some like onion, carrots, and celery going in the fat I seared the bones in, put the bones back in, some broth, and then some tomato sauce and let that simmer for 3 hours. And that was like an incredibly delicious tomato sauce.
Yum.
And then the day after that, I boiled some chickpeas and, you know, ended up being like, well, what am I going to do with these chickpeas? Oh, I have that leftover, you know, pork from the pork chops the first night, diced the pork chops, mixed it, probably like 2-to-1 chickpeas to pork. And a little bit of broth, a little bit of cumin, a little coriander, sauteed that up. Okay, I'll confess, like a cup of sour cream also. And then made tacos out of that. So like, oh, that one meal of pork chops is now stretched into like 4 meals for us.
That's
amazing. I mean, this is the way people have always cooked through history, right? And it's sort of trying to relearn those lessons from the past that like our ancestors have always known, to like provide for ourselves right now in a way that feels good and feels right and honestly feels safe.
Yeah. I mean, and I also have to say just at the top here, before we get into everything, I also ate, you know, last week I only ate it once, but I had a lunch that was Annie's mac and cheese with frozen peas and chili crisp, you know, like,
yeah.
And I'm a professional cook with all the skills, no kids and all the time. So like,
yeah.
Sometimes that's just what you got to eat. And, you know, as much as I do appreciate that a lot of people are turning to cooking as a salve for themselves right now and as a way to take care of themselves and bring joy, I also know there are a lot of parents out there who are, you know, under the same roof with their kids who they're trying to school. They're trying to like not get a divorce when this is done. They're doing both parents are doing full-time jobs, you know, who knows, they're maybe worried about their elderly parents and family members. So there's a lot of stress. And for some people, cooking might be a source of stress or maybe not every day, but sometimes. And I just want to say, you know, it's okay if you need to eat frozen pizza or chicken nuggets or order out, because also supporting a restaurant's not a bad idea. You know, it's not, it's not like a virtue. It's not a virtue that's going to make you like a better person who's going to, you know, win points.
Yeah.
If you do cook all your meals, you know, 20 in a row or something.
Yeah.
Don't worry. It's super not a race.
Yeah. I was at a supermarket the other day and for the first time in forever. That's a Frozen song, isn't it? For the first time in forever. I was like, ooh, processed food. This is great.
One of my friends who's an amazing chef yesterday said, she was like, all I want to eat is a queso. I just want Rotel and Velveeta. Yeah. And I was like, well, now's the time.
Yeah,
you got to go get
jars.
Some. And she's like, no, everywhere is sold out. There's no Velveeta or Rotel anywhere.
Oh, God.
I was like, that's a national emergency.
That's Samin Nosrat, author and star of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and we'll be back with more with her in a minute, and we'll be taking your cooking questions, including how to cook chicken when you are already sick of chicken. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So we're spending this episode with the award-winning author and host of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Samin Nosrat, who's helping me answer a boatload of quarantine cooking questions from our listeners. So we can't actually take your calls live right now since we don't have a studio, but we love to hear from you. So you can just record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us, contact@splendidtable.org. Or you can call and leave a voicemail at 1-800-537-5252. Let's get to your questions with Samin. Okay, so we promised our listeners that we would answer their questions and calls with you.
Ooh, I can't
and
wait.
Yeah, you ready?
Surprise
to go for
me.
It? Okay, all right. So let's start with Kim from Florida.
Hey, Splendid Table. This is Kim from Florida. Help! We're so sick of chicken, but what do we have defrosted tonight? Two chicken breasts. My husband needs to be on a heart-healthy diet, but we kind of love spice. You got any great ideas for some chicken, maybe some chicken broth, and any interesting spices? Before he kills me for making more chicken, please send help. Thanks.
Okay, so order of business is no violence in the home. It's so funny because I have been desperate for chicken because I've been eating a sausage because I'm like, we can't go to the store. What do you think? Two chicken breasts and they're already sick of chicken.
I know what to do.
Let's hear
I have
it.
An idea. I should say, I'm not sure it's like the best in the world, but as she was speaking, I had an idea, which was cook it in such a way so that it can get shredded. Mm. And what immediately came to mind for me was kind of to make like a taco kind of filling, you know?
Yeah.
So if I had a can of tomatoes, or another thing that would be so good is if you had those canned chipotle peppers in adobo sauce. But yeah, you could just use an onion, a little broth, and you basically braise the chicken breasts. You could brown them on either side and then just put them in a little pot or pan covered with some liquid and just simmer them till they're tender and then shred them and mix them with this delicious juice that you've made. I would probably put some chili flake if I didn't have the chipotle and some ground cumin. That's I'm like an overuser of cumin for sure. If I had cilantro, I would put in some fresh cilantro at the end. Yeah, and just make kind of like a stewed shredded chicken for a burrito filling or a taco filling.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. It's funny, I was thinking a similar thing, kind of going the other direction in terms of like not cooking it so long where you can shred it, but poaching it, right?
Ooh, yeah.
And so keeping it really nice and tender and then dice it up small. And I was thinking maybe if you have like carrots, blanch some carrots. If you have other vegetables, certainly some sauteed onion or things like that. I don't know if she has herbs available, but maybe some fresh herbs, even some mint or something. And then do like sort of a warm chicken salad-y kind of thing.
Ooh.
And if you have lettuce, do it with lettuce cups and make a Vietnamese nook chum.
Oh my God, that sounds so good.
Yeah, God, yeah. I've been like waiting for the moment to make that.
That sounds so good.
So nook chum is a combination of fish sauce, hot water, sugar, lime juice, and often there's a little bit of diced, like finely minced garlic and finely minced chilies if you like that. And it's just this incredibly delicious, savory, little bit sweet, little bit sour dressing you could splash on stuff. And that'd be great with lettuce cups or like that with rice. It's not all chicken all day long, right? It's mm-hmm. chicken as a part of this other combination of textures and flavors. And
maybe some cucumber.
Yeah, cucumber would be great. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so good. Now I want that.
Yeah. And so if she's in Florida, I mean, they might be getting tomatoes. I mean, Florida produces tomatoes year-round, right? But like something just fresh and light that doesn't feel like it's like, oh boy, here's another roasted chicken breast.
Ooh, that sounds so good. Let's go eat that with her.
Yeah.
In our imagination.
Yeah, we can't. All right. Hope that helps, Kim. Let's
good luck,
go to
Kim.
Our... Yeah.
Gosh. And Kim's husband.
Yeah. The two of you love each other. Now is the time to stay loving each other. Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, where we have a message from Hannah and Chase.
My name's Hannah.
And my name's Chase.
And we're here stuck in home in Des Moines, Iowa from college. And recently, our parents have been getting really creative and making really some yummy, delicious meals in the kitchen, and we're wanting to give back. But we're still on a somewhat college budget and only claim college culinary skills, and we're wondering if you had any ideas. Please let us know what you think.
Thanks.
I think college culinary skills, you know, they're nothing to sneeze at.
I don't know what they mean by college culinary skills. Like, do they mean like, oh, we're really good at going to get burritos?
Like, well, what's funny is I always, like, college, until I started cooking in a restaurant, I have this joke where I'm like, oh, college, that was my cheese and carbs phase, where it was like pizza, quesadillas, grilled cheese, mac and cheese.
Okay, that is my kid's lunch every day, so let's not mock it.
But like I said earlier, you know, I do think constraint is a gift in the kitchen. And so if, you know, you feel limited because all you know how to do, let's say, is to use a slow cooker or to make something with a cheese and a carb, then make something with a cheese and a carb or use a slow cooker. I don't think you have to all of a sudden, you know, be educated in the culinary arts to be able to produce a meal that people are going to appreciate right now.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think if it's like they're helping, mm-hmm. maybe they, you know, make a simple vinaigrette and make the salad for the night, and definitely, mm-hmm. definitely do the dishes. You know, yeah. Like, you know, to your point, if you're like, if college culinary skills mean like cheese, pasta, and we know how to open beer, like go ahead and make mac and cheese for dinner that night. And I'm sure everyone will be psyched about it.
Yeah, totally. And a couple ideas, I think, for things if you want to, I don't know, learn something new or mm-hmm. just challenge yourself. What I've seen on the internet happening right now is something I have not personally yet been inspired enough to do this, but I do think it's a great time for people who have been curious about making bread. And I think the no-knead bread and the no-knead doughs are a great place to start.
Yes.
So those recipes abound on the internet. And, you know, a loaf of fresh, crusty bread right now is a luxury, I think. Like today I found one at the grocery store. I was like, jackpot! Because that's something that, you know, can be turned into, you know, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. And then once it gets stale, you can turn it into so many other things. Like, I'm going to use some crusty old bread for my meatballs and ribollita soup. So I think you don't need to necessarily think about how do I, like, produce a whole meal or take care of a meal plan for a day or a week, as much as how do I just add to my family's, you know, pantry and our larder.
Yeah. Yeah. And something like ribollita is awesome because it is a way, again, right now, if a lot of people are trying to stay home as much as possible and not go to the store super often, stale bread cooked into like a bean soup, a little bit of tomato, it thickens the soup. It turns it almost into a porridge.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Porridge is like the saddest word because like for such a delicious, comforting food, it sounds so gross. Like that word porridge is like, ugh. But it's like, it's almost like a polenta, right? Like you just cook the bread into it until it smooths out a little bit and you splash some olive oil on top and like, it's just yummy. And it's
It's so good. And the best ribollita I ever had is from this restaurant outside of Florence called Da Delfina. And they, what they do is they take this soup, which is like a bean and kale and bread soup that is so thick because they put so much bread in it that you really eat it with a fork and not a spoon. And they take their ribollita, which is day old, and they fry it in a frying pan on both sides. And so you get this incredible browning, like this beautiful sort of pancake.
Oh God, that's incredible.
It's like a soup pancake, a bean and soup pancake. And so it's served on a plate and not in a bowl and with a fork. And so if you were to somehow, look how I went straight from like, you guys don't need to do anything, but
Okay, here's a 9-step dish using old bread that you first
baked. I would like you to attempt. But that kind of is like the weird slope of this sort of everlasting cooking that we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly your can of beans or your pot of beans, your weird crusty bread, your kale stems that maybe you weren't going to mix into anything else, that cabbage that's been in the back of the fridge for a while, a couple potatoes that are sprouting eyes, all mm-hmm. that stuff, and a can of tomatoes turns into this amazing soup that you can then pan fry.
And even if you don't pan fry.
Yeah, it's so good. All okay. right, hit me with another one.
Okay. Thank you, Hannah and Chase. Hope that helps. Again,
thanks, Hannah and Chase.
The TLDR version is do the dishes and maybe make the salad or make the bread. Or if you need to make quesadillas, do it, because I'm sure your parents would love a night off. Okay, let's go to Elle in Minneapolis.
Hi, Splendid Table. This is Ellie in Minneapolis. I have an interesting combo where I have a bunch of shrimp in the freezer and a one-year-old baby. And I'm wondering what kind of a meal I could make with the shrimp that would be a hit with the whole family, including the one-year-old. Thanks for your help.
Okay, Ellie.
That's so funny, the way she...
I'm sorry I mispronounced your name, but I also was really confused when you said the interesting combo you had was shrimp in the freezer and the baby. I was distressed. But you want shrimp the baby will eat.
That's a good question. Wait, Francis, you know more about what one-year-olds will eat, so maybe you start out.
You know, I am happy to start because I literally made something with shrimp that the kids were like mowing down last night. We happen to have a 2-pound bag of shrimp in the fridge, in the freezer rather. And okay, so this is, I have to give credit for this recipe. It goes to the chef, Hugh Atchison, who is an author that I work with. I thought to make it because I was editing his, you know, upcoming book. And I was like, this recipe has 5 ingredients and I can make it tonight. So basically, this is a delicious, super easy shrimp and leek pasta. And the way it works is this. You take, well, okay, this is for 4 people. I made it for 7, so I basically doubled it. But for 4 people, you take 2 leeks. You wash the leeks. So the thing with leeks is they're great. They have wonderful flavor. You can use them a million different ways, but they can be really, really dirty. So cut off the dark green parts. This is pale and light green. I keep the dark green parts because they're delicious for stock or even just like sauteed on their own for whatever reason. Recipe writers hate dark green parts of leeks. I love them, but in this recipe, I want to follow the recipe. So I set the dark green parts aside to keep them for later. The white and light green parts, you split them in half. So like when they're still a cylinder, so you split them in half and then you run them under running water and you kind of like flip them like you were flipping a deck of cards to get all the dirt out in between the layers. Then slice them thin into little half moons. For those 2 leeks, it's like 2 or maybe 3 tablespoons of butter in a saute pan. Saute those leeks over like medium heat, so they're just sort of softening. You're not necessarily needing them to brown, just kind of let them melt, a little bit of salt. Meanwhile, you get your shrimp ready, and 1 pound of shrimp. If they're frozen, defrost them. If they're not frozen, you sort of salt them on a plate, take the shells off. When the leeks are like really nice and melty, then you add 1/2 cup of stock, your choice, vegetable, chicken, shrimp, whatever stock, 1/2 cup of sour cream, so you know it's delicious.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Salt and pepper, season up, red chili flakes if you want, a little bit of lemon zest if you want, and that's your sauce. You cook your pasta. When the pasta's just about ready, you add the shrimp to that sauce, cook the shrimp in the sauce just until the shrimp is opaque. It'll just take a few minutes. You toss that with your pasta, maybe a little splash of the pasta water if you need a little bit more sauciness, and it was such a hit. And it literally, like, it was like 20, 30 minutes, and it
that
was
sounds good.
Fantastic. All right, Ellie, have fun with that. Have fun with your baby. Let's go to Silver Spring, Maryland, and Quentin.
Hey, Samin. My name is Quentin, and I'm calling from Silver Spring, Maryland. My family and I are locked away these days like everyone else, and I would love to try a Persian recipe, something simple and comforting. Thanks so much.
That's a nice question.
Yeah.
Quentin, you're in like Persian epicenter over there in Maryland. So there's probably a Middle Eastern grocery store you can get some basmati rice at. Mm. And if you don't have basmati rice, you can start with some long grain rice and make yourself a tadig, a Persian crispy rice, which in the minds of many Iranians, you know, the measure of a cook is how good her tadig is. But I kind of have spent a while tweaking and simplifying a tadig recipe to make it really, really doable for everyone. So it is all over the internet, but I'm going to explain it so that, honestly, I think if you just follow these steps, you'll be able to get it. But the difference between Persian rice and other kinds of rice that we're used to eating is that it's cooked twice in two different sort of steps. And then it also has two different textures. The rice at the bottom of the pot, which translates to tadig, bottom of the pot, becomes crispy and fried, while the rest of the rice is super fluffy, like so fluffy that it cooks up in individual grains. And in order to get that, you have to rinse your rice and get all of the starch off. As much starch as possible needs to exit the rice before it's cooked. So my mom, for example, would soak a cup of rice per person. And Iranians eat a lot of rice, so we do it a cup per person. I think everyone else, a half a cup is plenty. So
a cup of rice per person is, that's like three cups of cooked rice. That is pro level rice eating.
Yeah, but we, like, I grew up in a house where the rice was the main thing, right? And then we just garnished it with some sauce. And, like, the idea, I had never had seen meat as the center of the plate until I worked in restaurants in my 20s. Mm-hmm, I really was used to rice with vegetables as the main part of my plate. Anywho, start with half a cup of rice per person. So say you're cooking for four. You can take two cups of long grain rice and soak them and change the water until it runs clear. So that might take three or four changes of water. My mom would soak for many hours, but if you don't have time to do that, you can just rinse it. And then it goes into a big pot of heavily salted water, and you cook it until it's al dente. It really has to be still quite hard in the middle. So for every different kind of rice, that'll be, you know, or brand of basmati or whatever, it'll be slightly different, but it's anywhere from like right when the water comes back up to a boil to maybe up to 6 minutes. So I'll just stand there and sort of check and drain it into a colander that I have in the sink.
So you're cooking it like pasta.
Rinse. Yeah, just like pasta, exactly.
Not like steamed rice.
And then I'll rinse with cold water, both to stop the cooking of the rice and to rinse away even more starch. And then I'll let that drain. And while that's draining, maybe I'll taste a couple grains of it. And if it needs more salt, I'll salt the whole batch, you know, just sort of sprinkle salt and toss it around. And then this is the fun part. So traditionally, we would use the very traditional ancient Teflon pot. That's what every Iranian lady uses, but most people don't have Teflon pots. So if you have a nonstick pan, you can stick that on the stove. Otherwise, you could just use a cast iron pan, as long as it's really nicely seasoned, and get maybe, I don't know, maybe I do a mix of butter and oil. So I would do probably 3 tablespoons of butter and 3 tablespoons of oil. You need kind of a lot of fat in there. And get that sort of gently warming over like medium low heat, and take a cup or so of the cooked rice aside and make like a little rice and yogurt paste. If you have yogurt, you could do about, I don't know, 1 or 2 tablespoons of yogurt. And then you're going to press that yogurty rice into the bottom of the pan. Just spread it using a spatula, and that'll become the foundation for your tadig. Then you can put the rest of the cooked rice in over, and you use the back of a wooden spoon to poke holes all the way down to the bottom of the pan, and you're going to turn up the heat to sort of medium high. So you want to start hearing a sizzle and see steam coming off. And what those holes do is they let steam escape so that the very bottom of the pan doesn't become soggy, so that it becomes as crispy as possible. And for maybe about, like, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes, you're just going to sort of cook that until you start smelling some browning happening, and you even start seeing some of the rice on the edge of the pan becoming like just lightly golden. And then you're going to turn the heat down to pretty much as low as it goes. And this is the weird and fun part, is I cook it in 4 equal sort of times of about 12 minutes, 10 to 12 minutes. And I at each sort of 10 to 12 minute mark, I turn the pan a quarter turn, and that's how you're going to get an even sort of brown, because no burner in any kitchen is perfectly even. So this is the way to ensure that you get even browning. And then when you're done, you flip it out onto a cutting board or onto a serving tray, and you have this incredibly like crispy, crunchy, nutty, like sort of yummy, yummy, yummy crispy rice that every Iranian kid and family fight over. And then you get the inside fluffy rice. And this is my ultimate comfort food. It's so good. And you can eat it with basically anything you have around. Iranians eat yogurt on everything. So I would like a really simple meal would be rice, buttery rice with a spoonful of yogurt and a fried egg. That's like a simple dinner my mom would make. But you can also, you know, turn it into something a little fancier. You could make any sort of saucy meat or saucy vegetable and serve it alongside that. But honestly, I just wouldn't stand there and eat the dadig on my own.
Oh, God. Crunch, crunch, crunch. That sounds awesome. So, Quentin, go make some dadig.
Yeah. In Farsi, we say Nushajun, which is kind of like our bon appetit.
That's the author and teacher, Samin Nosrat, host of the new podcast, Home Cooking. And we'll be back with more of your questions. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. We're spending this episode taking your quarantine cooking questions with Samin Nosrat. She's the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and the host of the brand new podcast, Home Cooking. Now, back to your questions. All right, we got time for probably a couple more. Let's do Sarah in Los Angeles.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and my question is, during this coronavirus pandemic, what are the ingredients that we can freeze? For example, on my infrequent grocery runs, I try to buy a little more than I might need for, let's say, a few days, things like garlic and so on. And I have read different things about freezing things like garlic, but I'm not sure what can actually go in the freezer or not. Anyway, just trying to stretch our ingredients and trying not to go out unless I absolutely need to. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I am absolutely obsessed with this issue of like how to best store and use stuff. So again, you don't have to go to the store that often right now. I would say garlic and ginger, garlic you just leave out. There's no reason to put it in the freezer. And ginger, you can do that as well, although it does a little bit better in the fridge. But aside from those things, like, do you know of like rules, like what can freeze and what should freeze and what shouldn't freeze?
I don't know of any like steadfast rules, but I have lots of tips. I'm really into this question too. Also, I always think it'd be really funny if I had a podcast called Should I Eat That? Like, because I think people like have this really interesting relationship to expiration dates.
Yeah.
And, you know, are very, you know, understandably worried about things going bad. But I maybe err on the other side. But yeah, definitely ingredients that come out of the ground that are cured, things like garlic, potatoes, ginger, all that kind of stuff, it will be fine in a cool, airy, dark cabinet. Ginger, you can actually peel and slice and freeze if you want, if that makes you feel better. But also, like, it will be fine in your fridge for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
It's the much more perishable stuff that I'm kind of thinking about a lot. Like today, in fact, I actually had a very sad moment where I had to throw a bunch of milk down the drain.
Wee.
And I was kicking myself because I was like, man, if I had come to this yesterday, I would have made rice pudding.
Yeah.
So, but in terms of, let's see, meat products, to me, the things that are going to freeze more successfully are the things that are less lean, more fatty.
Mm-hmm.
So sausages, bacons, and then all of the things that we would consider stew cuts or braising cuts are going to freeze more and honestly defrost and cook more successfully because they're going to suffer less from that loss of liquid that's inevitable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then in general, for vegetables, what works best in my experience is lightly cooking it and then freezing it in a single layer until it's solid and then throwing it into a freezer bag. So for spinach, that might mean like sauteing or blanching it, squeezing out the excess water, chopping it up, freezing it in a single layer, putting it in a bag. For peas or corn or I don't know anyone who's getting peas and corn this time of year, but I'll say if you really like got your first asparagus or any other greens, that's probably what I would do is like cook it really quickly in salted water and then freeze it. Anything else that you're like cooking all day, things like beans and stews, things that have really, really cooked and are saucy in liquid,
yes.
Those are also, I think, prime things to freeze. Yeah. And you want to always freeze them covered in liquid because yeah. that will help them defrost better.
Yeah, totally. And like I think about the freezer as a place for, okay, if you buy things frozen, you keep it frozen, right? Mm-hmm. But I wanna prioritize freezer space right now for exactly what you're talking about. Things you've cooked in maybe a big batch. Maybe you have a lot of Tupperware, you can portion it out into like one or two servings and then freeze those. So then you can have basically your own frozen dinners, right? So I wanna prioritize my freezer space for that.
And totally. Like
produce, yes, most of it is freezable, but often if it's delicate produce, like you said, like cooking it first, just it lets it freeze a little better. I think you can correct me on the science of this, but I think what happens is in cooking it, you're already kind of like breaking some of the cell structure and the juices that need to come out will come out. And like, and so when it refreezes, the freezing action isn't like shredding those
as devastating.
Cells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you. I have a very, very, very small freezer myself.
Mm.
So it's very precious, the space. So like last week I made a big, huge pot of chicken stock and there was no way I was going to be able to freeze it all. So I reduced it. I boiled it away by half.
Mm.
And then I was able to freeze that in smaller cups.
Yeah.
And then now when I am using it, I just sort of add water back in.
Brilliant.
But Sarah, I hope that helps. I do think there is this general sort of feeling of fear and anxiety that everyone has, this kind of panic of running out of food. And I don't think for me myself... And again, like we're all coming at this from different places. If there's any way to let go of any of that fear, I think your day-to-day experience is going to be a lot lighter. And I think if we all sort of just focus on and really commit to not hoarding,
yeah,
there will be enough for everyone. You know, as long as we're responsible and do our best to, you know, use and preserve and not waste what we have, There should be enough for everyone.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. And like, I get the urge to panic shop, but everything we're hearing right now is, you know, the supplies will still be there and it just makes it harder for other people if you're buying more than what you need for a couple of weeks at a time.
Yeah, especially the people who are the most vulnerable. You know, I think they're the ones who get the shortest end of the stick when other people... you know, take more resources.
Yeah.
So just like we started talking about, I think taking care of each other and like all of the small ways in which people really are being open-hearted is so inspiring. So it's a nice reminder that we can do that sort of with our food too.
Right. For sure. Yeah. All right. I think we have time for one more. And for that, we're going to go to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hey!
Hello.
We're Quail. We're a house of friends living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we're cooking Sichuan style gnocchi tonight. My name is Ben.
I'm Yupi.
I'm TC.
And this week we're gonna start brewing kombucha, and we're really excited about it. Something we're wondering is, can we use kombucha like wine? Can we use kombucha to cook with? Can we pair kombucha with dishes? How would you suggest using kombucha like wine?
Oh my God, I love these guys.
Yeah.
I love that they were cooking while they were recording.
I love Sichuan style gnocchi. I don't know what that is, but I want to eat some.
I know, it sounds good. What do you know about kombucha cooking?
I know that you live in California, so that means you know more about it.
Okay,
than I do.
I actually have some things to say. So, I'm like, oh, you got. I have a funny. This is you're probably gonna want to cut this, but whatever. I had a friend in New York who really wanted to start making kombucha, so we brought it. I brought him a SCOBY once from California, which is the I forget what SCOBY stands for, but it's the mother. And I packed it in a Ziploc bag, in kombucha, and put it in my boot in my suitcase. So that it would be safe. And brought it. And he's obsessed with the West Wing, so he named his SCOBY Toby the SCOBY. Anywho. Sorry, that was really boring.
Totally. No, I love boot SCOBY. What a boot delicious SCOBY. Start to any project is the
totally.
Boot SCOBY.
It was very successful, made delicious kombucha. No, I've made it my own self, and there's actually this amazing place in Berkeley that makes the most delicious kombucha I've ever had. And
well, first,
can
you explain to people what kombucha is?
Oh, sure. Kombucha is an ancient fermented tea. Kombu, I think, refers to the SCOBY, which kind of looks like a floating a floating mother in a jar, like a slimy jellyfish, that pancake at the top of the fermenting jar. And then cha just means tea. So it's a fermented tea. So it just starts with, like, usually the mother, water, some sugar to get the fermenting going, and some tea. And then when it's done with its first round of fermentation, you can add some more sugar and put it in a, like, a closed container so that then it becomes fizzy and carbonated, which is how I like to drink it. And then a lot of times people at that point will mix in ginger, fresh ginger juice, or any other fruit juices to get all the different flavors of kombucha. And it is like an acquired taste. When I first had it, I thought it was disgusting because it's definitely fermenty tasting. But then I suddenly had total change of heart, and now I'm obsessed with it. And someone I knew called it soda for hippies, which is kind of a good way to describe it, I think. And so,
and would you cook with it?
Well, if you leave the kombucha for too long, it will start to taste vinegary, in which case I think you could use it in a vinegary way. And there's this amazing fermenting lady named Alex Hovson in Alex. Her name's Alex. I'm so sorry for butchering your name, Alex. And she has a company called Cultured Pickles in Berkeley. And she is probably the most masterful fermenter I've ever met. And she can turn anything into something fermented, traditional from around the world. And she does these lunches called Rice and Pickles, where you go sit around the table at her spot. And they have, honestly, in a lunch that's like a bowl of rice and pickles and a glass of kombucha and one little other thing. Oh, and a little miso. You've probably eaten 40 different fermented things that she's made out of all different ingredients. She wastes nothing. Like how you were talking about the leek tops. She'll use the leek tops and the leek roots, you know, and make things out of that. It's just, it's so extraordinary. But at her place, I've had dishes where the kombucha has been used as like a source of vinegar, a vinegary taste. So anywhere that you might use vinegar, even like a vinaigrette, I think you could use kombucha. Certainly stuff that's gone a little too far. I've never cooked with it in like a heated dish. I can't imagine why one couldn't. It would probably be delicious to use as a braising, like as a braising acid, actually. You know, we put beer in braises, so why not put a little kombucha? And in terms of pairing it, well, I drink it with everything, so.
California girl.
But like, friends, I love you guys. I love the spirit of your, of everything. And also, I really would like it if you would send me a recipe for your Szechuan gnocchi.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Ben, Yuki, and TC. And thank you, Samin. I think that's our time.
Thanks, Francis. It's been so like warm and cozy chatting with you. Same. I love cooking with you virtually.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day.
Cook in real person. But I love the way you describe the way sour cream coats a pasta noodle.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with sour cream. That's my takeaway of the show.
Me too.
Go get some sour cream.
Totally. Or make your own.
God, California. All right. Thank you again.
Thanks, Francis. Take care.
I'll be listening to your podcast. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Samin Nosrat is the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, host of the new podcast Home Cooking, and in case you need something to look forward to, she's working on a new book, too. That is our show for the week. We hope you found it helpful, and please let us know what you want to hear from us these days, how we can be useful and inspiring or just fun to help you de-stress. And keep calling or sending in your cooking questions. You can email us voice memos, just record them on your phone and send them to contact@splendidtable.org, or you can call old school and leave us a message, 1-800-537-5252. Thanks so much for listening. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your community. Stay inside if you can. We'll talk to you next week. You can listen to all of our podcasts, including our latest collection we're calling Extras, where we revisit some of our most helpful or inspiring conversations around home cooking to help you with all the extra cooking you're doing. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, subscribe to our weekly email. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday to make your dinner time a little easier. Go to splendidtable.org to sign up. This show comes together with the help of our team, Jenny Lubke, Jennifer Russell, Erica Romero, Chip Walton, and Sally Swift. Special thanks this week to Lisa Bittman. We could not have done this without you. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.